Have you ever heard a lie from me? They answered, No, we have not seen or heard anything but truth and honesty from you. Then the Prophet said, If I tell you that a bloodthirsty enemy is in ambush and intends to attack you, will you deny me and sit idly? Having drawn the audience's attention, the Messenger of Mercy continued, Now, if I tell you that the horsemen of enemy are approaching from behind this mountain to attack you, will you believe any word? Know and beware that after this life, you will have a tumultuous world, a world which has ample pains, sufferings, punishments, tortures, miseries, and deprivations. Therefore, I warn you of the tough punishment that is ahead of you and remind you of its dangers. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, started his great uprising with the aim of reviving the religion of his ancestor, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In his historical speech in 1964, he warned everyone against ratification of the humiliating capitulation bill, which was a total breach of Iran's national sovereignty and would give unilateral concessions to the U.S. The Imam said, Gentlemen, I announce alarm. O Iran's army, I announce alarm. O politicians of Iran, I announce alarm. O tradesmen of Iran, I announce alarm. O ulema of Iran, O sources of emulation of Islam, I announce alarm. O seminary teachers, O seminary students, O sources of emulation, O gentlemen of Najaf, Qom, Mashhad, Tehran, Shiraz, I announce alarm. Ayatollah Khamenei, as the successor of Imam Khomeini, says, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a wise worshipper who succeeded to liberate himself of ungodly bonds and became God's truthful servant. He made a calm heart and luminous inward for himself and totally joined God. Ayatollah Khamenei testifies that whenever all the Iranian officials came to impasse in their relevant affairs, they would come to the Imam and he would grant them calm and hope. Leader of the Islamic Revolution says, Imam Khomeini, through spiritual relations and trust in God, would always stand like a sturdy and firm mountain, and nothing could shake him. In most of the developments of this country and the events of the revolution, all burdens were on Imam's shoulder. In the events, he would guide all officials and people with one sentence and would end weakness and anxieties. Imam Khomeini would never consider himself superior to others. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, The Imam was the person who managed to change and replace all world policies with his power. That strong will before which big mountains were small That expressive tongue whose world would explode like a bomb in the world effectively. Whenever people were mentioned, he would consider himself inferior and would humbly bow down before the sentiments, faith, courage, greatness, and self-sacrifice of the people and would say, "People are better than us." The Noble Quran says in Ayah 24 of Surah Anfal, "O you who have faith, answer Allah and His Apostle when He summons you to which will give you life. Know that Allah intervenes between a man and his heart, and that toward Him you will be mustered." In fact, a religion can be reviving only when it is living and dynamic. Imam Khomeini believed that the genuine Islam has its roots in the teachings and practice of the Prophet and his infallible progeny, the Ahlul Bayt. He maintained that Islam is always living and will never be dormant and passive. Hence, during the period of occultation of the Imam of the age, it is religious leaders and aware ulama who should take the helm of guiding the Islamic community. According to the clear message of the Quran, the Imam was of the opinion that Muslims should never be under the dominance of the faithless. He ceaselessly struggled against injustice and corruption. God says in Ayah 25 of Surah Hadid, "Certainly we sent our apostles with manifest proofs, and we sent with them their book and the balance, so mankind may maintain justice." Imam Khomeini too set on justice as the axis and core of the Islamic Republic system. In the Islamic Republic, Islamic justice is practiced. The divine justice shades over the entire nation, and in the Islamic Republic, there won't be the things that existed in during the tyranny. No doubt, Imam was the greatest reviver of Islam and religious thought after the infallible Imams. His ultimate goal was to revive pure Muhammadan Islam. He never considered religion a limited number of individual actions, and rather believed that religion is present in every corner of the social life. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran not only led the Islamic Revolution to victory in Iran, but also created the spirit of unity and Islamic brotherhood among Muslim communities. Imam Khomeini called the Islamic Revolution as the explosion of light. Today, we witness that the rays of this light have gone across Islamic and even non-Islamic countries to show the path of a struggle against tyranny and oppression to all seekers of freedom and justice. Imam Khomeini strongly proved to the world that religion is capable of administering the society to guarantee mankind's welfare in this world and salvation in the hereafter.
Movement.
Stay.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
on Youth Station.
In the name of God, salam, all the listeners, everyone who's listening to us from all around the world, dear sisters and brothers, we are with you. Here is IRB English Radio. We're having another session of the Youth Station, and today we're having some interesting topics for you as well.
Yeah, choo-choo-ka-choo, it's the Youth Station for you. You were waiting
yes,
for it, right?
Yes, of course. And there's no start without choo-choo-ka-choo. Here with us, we have...
Muzaffar here.
Yes, we have our brother Muzaffar.
I wanted to start with a story.
I love stories.
Yeah, so I have a potentially very upbeat, friendly, happy personality.
That's very good.
Potentially. Because a lot of the times what I've noticed is what happens is when I go into certain environments with that attitude, there'll always be one person who kind of pokes at it. Yeah.
That's too bad.
And when they poke
when
at it,
happens.
It makes you go, oh, okay, and then it makes
like
you retreat.
They crush you.
Yeah, it makes you
retreat.
You
hold back.
Yeah. Have you experienced, you've experienced that?
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
So I'm friendly until I am in that situation, and then I hold back.
Yeah.
Like I regret what I have done.
It's not fair, though. Why can't you just be yourself? And why do you have to poke fun? Just because you know, you don't speak freely and happily, and you know, you're not openly friendly with people. Why can't you just let me be that? Why do you have to poke at me?
At some point, I would say that it's very much natural. It's very sad to put it this way, but nowadays life has become in a way, I don't like modern life because everything has changed. All the good things have turned into bad things, and all the bad things have turned into good things. So when there is someone who's happy, who's chirpy, and who's very much friendly, there is not much of, perhaps some people, of course, I'm not saying everyone, some people don't see that as a good point. They take that as something, they would consider you as a happy, easygoing person. Yeah. They don't know that you are a human being and you're going through the same situations like them. You're going through the difficulties as well. Life is sometimes very much daunting and overwhelming, but you are trying to keep yourself in a place where you cheer people up or add some flavor into life. I mean,
actually, it reminded me that I did that myself once as well. It was when I was in the UK and I was working at this in a sales environment. It was really loud, really.
Yes.
But in that environment, I was kind of the quiet, shy one.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Sometimes you find yourself in a different environment where you feel like, oh, I need to be a bit quiet here. When I was supposed to be like really loud and friendly, there was one guy who was really nice, like really nice guy, and he was just friendly, open, speaking openly, making jokes all the time. And for some reason, I made a snide comment about him.
So,
you know, I kind of said, oh yeah, something nasty about him.
So it happens to all of us, perhaps.
It's really bad, but that helped me to realize the mentality of somebody. Because I was shy, because I was afraid of being like him,
that's one of the reasons.
Some weird desire to kind of bring him down. It's Shaitan. I'm telling you, sister, it's Shaitan.
Yes, true.
Shaitan could never have the strength to be like Adam.
Yes.
Right, and so because he was not the chosen one, he wanted to bring the chosen one down.
Exactly.
This is
the
really
comparison
devilish.
He made.
You know, and this is, I feel like it's, have you heard of the crab effect?
Crab effect?
It's this,
what is it?
It's a metaphor, basically. If you put lots of crabs into a pot,
Yes.
Some of the crabs will climb on top of the other crabs and it will finally reach the top to climb out.
Yes.
But what will happen is that the crabs underneath will claw him down.
Yes, yes.
And so none of the crabs will ever leave.
A good analogy.
They'll never leave because whenever one does reach it, he'll be pulled down by the others.
Exactly.
And that's, I feel, what a lot of humanity has become. We are just desperately clawing and pulling others down because we're afraid that we won't make it. And this is really...
like dominoes. If one falls, the other one has to fall as well.
Yeah, and we are all falling.
We all are falling.
and that's not what it sounds like.
It's tragic.
It's really, yeah, life is tragic, guys. Don't forget that. Quote, Sister Asma, life is tragic.
Yes.
And by the way, there was something else you said about society having become such that all good things are looking...
bad.
Yeah, they're being presented as bad things. I was talking to a youth recently, and he was saying that he was walking with his university friends.
Yes, with his colleagues.
He's from the UK.
Yes.
And he said that I saw some school children and they were running, and it made me really happy because it reminded me of my school days.
Yes.
And I said, you know what? I really love children. Mm-hmm. And his friend made fun out of him.
Wow.
This is the kind of environment that the West has really become, where in Iran, now that I'm in Iran, like, I freely, like, when a kid walks past, right, a child, you know, I feel comfortable putting my hand on his head and, you know, just scruffling his hair a little bit, because they're cute, they're kids.
Yes, they are.
In the West, I would never dare to do that, because you can actually get arrested. You don't know which parent is going to turn around and say, how dare you touch my child?
That's horrendous.
That's what the society has become like, right? So even something as simple and completely human as loving children, even if they're not your own children, but just loving children generally, is seen as something suspicious.
Wow, yes, that's very bad.
That's the way society has become.
So one reason is because life is changing and modern society has imposed many things on our way of thinking and thoughts. So what about the other reasons? What makes us like this? Why? Why we do such things? Why there are some people who insult others?
Well, I think the crab effect is one part of it, right?
Yes.
They just don't want others to climb. They don't want others... if you're an imprisoned soul... the sight of somebody who is free disturbs you internally, and so you want that person to be a prisoner as well.
Oh, okay, that's very selfish.
And we're talking about a social prisoner, right? There's no physical bars that you can see, but there are so many people that when you look at them, you're like, man. And I'm sure that there are others who look at me in the same way, but I can sometimes see it. I'm just like, man, you are so much a slave of your own fears, for example.
Right?
Or you'll see a certain person and you'll be like, wow, you are so much a slave of, I don't know, desires or your what you're watching or, you know...
again, the story
trying to
of
please
the
other
self,
people,
yes.
Right? This person... I met one youth ages ago and, you know, you can just tell by looking at him the things that he says is he is desperate to please other people around him, make other people think that he's cool.
Yes, that is very sad.
Now that we're in the environment, you see so many people who are trying to present themselves as...
to prove yourself.
Yeah, so they can get that kind of reputation. They're a slave of their reputation.
Does that reputation really work?
Sometimes it does.
Is it satisfactory to them? I mean, right now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think it's very honorable thing. I won't feel honored if I do such things. Even if I get a reputation, I won't be happy with it.
Alhamdulillah, and if that's true, you know, inshallah, you should be very thankful for that. But you have to remember, sister, there's people who have actually literally made their careers on creating a false perception of themselves.
That false perception is not going to last forever. Eventually, the clouds would go away,
eventually,
and your true face is going to show.
Of course, yeah, eventually. But... yeah, I mean, if you look at the presidential race, for example, talking about people creating a kind of persona for themselves, I mean, it was just hilarious. You know, you got two presidents who are potential leaders of what is known as the free world, completely insulting each other.
Yes, that's true.
Insulting and bashing each other. You know, and if we want to understand why people insult each other, I think this is a good case study.
We should search in the self.
why is one insulting the other? Because he wants to be dominant over the other.
Yes, to prove themselves.
Right? I want to show that I am better than this.
I'm a stronger.
It is Shaitan, sister, if you really think about it.
Of course it is. Wherever there's the talk of the bad things, there is Shaitan.
That's
in the middle of that story.
Actual mentality of it is Shaitani, because why are you insulting somebody? You want to drag that person down. You want to exalt yourself.
Yes, to drag him into your own level.
I remember watching this children's show when I was really young. It was like, I can't remember if it was, do you remember Goosebumps?
Goosebumps, no, I haven't watched it.
So it was for kids back in the day, yes. Right? And they have these short, scary stories. One of the stories was about a girl who finds a witch who grants her three wishes.
What were the wishes?
I can't remember the other two, but one of the wishes was she wished that she would be the best on her team in basketball.
Like the mirror, who's the most beautiful person.
Yeah,
like that story.
Yeah.
Everyone is searching who's the best.
So this girl,
tell me who's the best.
Playing basketball with her team, right?
Yes.
And she was always the worst player. So she made a wish that I become the best player. So then she goes into the court and she's playing, and what's happened is everybody else on her team has become awful. They can barely dribble the ball. They can barely.
Then she was happy.
She wasn't happy. That was the point, right?
Yes.
Because it was meant to be a scary story. That, you know, be careful what you wish for, kind of thing.
Yes.
Right. That's what these people, what we as humanity, unfortunately, have become.
Yes.
We, instead of trying to strive for better, and those who are good, you know, push them to be even better. We actually want to drag everybody down.
And try to be like them. You can do your best to pull yourself up.
Yeah. Instead of picking ourselves up, trying to be the best in the team, we try and drag the whole team down so that we can look like the best. It's really scary.
It's horrible. Yes, that is. That truly is.
And that's why we insult.
Yes, very sad.
I think that's the main reason.
Now we talked about the insult itself and why we sometimes do the mistake of insulting other peoples or drag them down to our level. We said that there might be some personal issues behind that. Maybe you want to show yourself, you say that you're better, you're stronger, you're the dominant person. But then sometimes some people trigger you into a point where you are irritated.
I get triggered so easily.
They get under your skin and then things turn against you.
Mm.
So the person who has been insulting you is causing you to be irritated.
Mm-hmm.
That is very difficult to bear.
What do you do?
I can't say that I am very patient and I do not do anything, but most of the times when I'm too angry, I quit talking.
Uh-huh. You just go quiet.
Yes, that's a personal thing that happens every time. When I'm too angry and too desperate with the situation, I don't talk.
Mm-hmm. That's probably a good thing, to be honest.
Yes, that's a good thing, but sometimes it kills me from the inside because I want to explode, but there is not such a ability in me. This was all we could give you of the topic we talked about. Hope you're not tired and you enjoyed it all. Thank you, and until another session with Youth Station, may God be always on your side.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior. My giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Oh, now when I need you, oh. light when I seek you. Justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness. And my love is strong because you are the one I call creation.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Jeddah is the second largest city in Saudi Arabia and is home to 4.5 million people. Since late October, at least a million people in Jeddah have had their lives turned upside down amid a large-scale demolition push by the government. Residents say the demolitions have taken them by surprise and given them little to no room to plan their relocation because it was on short notice. The displacement has caused a housing crisis, with rental prices skyrocketing across the city. In some cases, rents have doubled in a matter of days and many aren't able to afford them. At least 10 neighborhoods have been completely wiped out so far, as work continues in around another 10 areas. The plan targets some 60 districts, mostly located in the city's southern part, and is expected to continue for months. Online footage and satellite images show the wide-scale destruction of entire neighborhoods, which have been turned into dust. In 2020, similar demolitions carried out in the northern Tabuk province made international headlines. Saudi Arabia's Al-Huwaitat tribe sent an urgent communication to the United Nations, calling for an investigation into allegations of forced displacement and abuse by Saudi authorities. Their request came after months of alleged harassment, arrests, and abductions by the Saudi forces, apparently due to the tribe's refusal to relocate to facilitate the government's Neom megacity project. Also, Saudi security forces killed an Al-Huwaitat tribe member, Abdulrahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al-Huwaiti, who was an activist protesting his eviction. He had also denounced the Neom project on several occasions. At least 20,000 members of the tribe now face eviction due to the project, with no information about where they will live in the future.
And they've even destroyed most of the religious monuments of people like the prophet, peace upon him, and his household. So this just bulldozing history and bulldozing tradition is really in their blood. So I'm not that surprised that they're doing this kind of nuclear scale urban renewal, so-called project in Jeddah.
The Saudi Crown Prince's desert dream, Neom, is due to completion in 2025 on Tabuk's Red Sea coast. It's a city designed to attract international investors, but has been subject to scrutiny since it was announced in 2017, with critics calling it wasteful and inefficient in addressing the problems of the Saudi economy, including unemployment and dependence on oil. Currently, over 11% of Saudi citizens are unemployed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's oil sector still contributes up to 80% of the country's budget revenues, while 88% of Saudi Arabia's foreign income is from oil exports. Details of the Neom project prompted a flurry of reactions when it was first announced, as people accused Mohammed bin Salman of using extravagant technology to cover up the kingdom's human rights abuses. Ever since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has ramped up arrests of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others perceived as political opponents, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnations of the crackdown. The destruction of communities on the Neom side follows decades of tensions between the House of Saud and the tribes it has ruled over since the creation of the Saudi state in 1932. Exerting control over the land through construction projects or destruction of some heritage sites have marked this rule. In 2017, the UN condemned the kingdom's forced demolition of the walled city of Awamiya in the eastern Katif region as violating human rights.
The United States military has come under intense scrutiny over its procedures to guard against civilian casualties after a high-profile mistaken drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that claimed the lives of 10 civilians, including 7 children, on August 29. The U.S. military initially said it successfully targeted a Daesh terrorist who was linked to the attack on the Kabul airport that killed over 100 people, including 13 U.S. troops. The latest study by the RAND Corporation think tank concluded that systemic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were resulting in it falling short of its duties on civilian casualties. It added that in conflicts, the U.S. military's access to targeted areas is limited both before and after strikes, and it relies on intelligence gathered remotely using sources like drone surveillance and satellite imagery.
Well, the United States regularly violates its own and international laws about related to war, but I do think the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its use of drones entirely. We know because of brave whistleblowers like Daniel Hale and other journalists who have reported on drones and drone use that the U.S. often uses faulty intelligence to conduct these strikes, which do result in lots of civilian casualties.
The RAND study, which was required by congressional legislation, found that the problem is compounded by the U.S. military when it fails to adequately talk to people from outside the U.S. government or armed forces who might have access to information on the ground. After the RAND study was released, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a memorandum calling for the creation of a plan on civilian harm mitigation and response in the months to come, as well as the creation of Civilian Protection Center later this year. A senior Pentagon official later admitted that the department's data gathering strategies have been faulty and expressed the need to incorporate the figures from other sources in American tallies. The U.S. runs nearly 700 overseas military bases in at least 80 countries around the world. Such widespread military presence means that Washington has been involved in many wars, either covertly or overtly, to secure its interests. Those wars almost always result in many civilian casualties. The question is how the U.S. is planning to reduce the number of civilians who pay the cost of the war on their country with their lives.
Yeah, I think for many reasons the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its foreign policy. We need to move away from war first and foremost because of the impact it has internationally on countries like Yemen and Afghanistan and other countries the U.S. has been involved in a war inside of in the last few years. Also, the environmental impact of war. War and militarism is driving the climate crisis. And also, we need to do things in the United States like cut the Pentagon budget to move us away from war and put more money towards things that actually matter, like free healthcare for all Americans and that sort of thing.
That being said, the simplest solution to the problem of civilian casualties overseas seems to be not conducting any such operations in the first place, as the U.S. military's track record in accepting accountability is far from acceptable and at the same time
the countries where the U.S. has deployed troops in are calling for their withdrawal.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists used explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism, but in reality it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halt its support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. Both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Mali's government has called on Denmark to immediately withdraw troops deployed to the West African nation. Malian officials say the reason to ask Copenhagen for the troops' withdrawal is because officials in Bamako were not consulted and the deployment failed to follow protocol. Mali says all troops' deployments in the country need a prior accord with the government before deployments in the African nation. The decision comes amid tension between Mali and regional bodies, and the European Union that have sanctioned Mali after the transitional government failed to organize elections following two military coups.
Danish forces, without identifying themselves to Malian authorities, committed a huge breach in regard to their internal security and also diplomatic relations between the two countries.
About 90 personnel, including sergeants and special forces, and logistics support, were deployed in Mali. Their mandate was supposed to last until early 2023. They were part of Takuba Task Force, which is made up of European special forces. It's based on an initiative by France. Takuba's 900 soldiers are to help Mali's army acquire the combat skills necessary to become self-reliant.
It's a very outrageous situation. I think they are victims of European imperialist intervention. France, which is a former colonial power, intervened 9 years ago, yet the security situation inside the country is far worse than it was in 2013.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 with the purported aim of countering militants linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France is a former colonizer of Africa. It has deployed thousands of soldiers to presumably prevent separatist forces from reaching Mali's capital, Bamako. In December, Paris withdrew from northern Mali and the city of Timbuktu 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or the French Parliament.
I do believe that France, you know, has committed grave errors in regard to its intervention in Mali.
The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. The withdrawal came amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence in Mali, which has been wracked by two military coups in little over a year.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries, including Burkina Faso. At the same time, we have a new rash of military interventions and seizures of power in all of these Sahel countries.
France has been one of the world's colonizing countries that, after many years of slavery, still controls countries spread over more than 12 territories and treats their people as second-class citizens. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of its former colonies gained independence.
Brutality prevails, and that is the imperialist hegemony seeking to extend its influence and maintain its influence internationally.
Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of resources. France currently has 5,100 troops in the arid and volatile Sahel region. Under a new plan, they will be reduced to up to 3,000 troops. Analysts say it's premature to call it the end of France's military intervention in Africa, believing Paris is only readjusting its post-colonial plans.
In the limelight.
It is now a year since the coup by the military in Myanmar that toppled the regime of that cruel woman, Aung San Suu Kyi. But nothing has improved for the Rohingya Muslims, a million of whom continue to languish as refugees in subhuman conditions in neighboring Bangladesh, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Misplaced trust worsens plight of Rohingya refugees. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. With the attention of most of the world turned towards the destruction of Yemen and the slaughter of its people by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the Ukraine crisis kicked up by the West to pressure Russia and the stepped-up efforts by the US, the super terrorist, to resurrect the Takfiri terrorism in Syria and Iraq, the plight of the world's most persecuted people has gone from bad to worse. It is now a year since the coup by the military in Myanmar that toppled the regime of that cruel woman, Aung San Suu Kyi. But nothing has improved for the Rohingya Muslims, a million of whom continue to languish as refugees in subhuman conditions in neighboring Bangladesh. Hopes of return home have died arose on February 1, 2021, when Army Chief Min Aung Hyung took control of the country and replaced President Win Myint with Vice President Min Soo, have long been dashed. As a matter of fact, cruelties seem to have increased under army rule, with harsher punishments for the Rohingyas attempting to return to their destroyed villages. Several of the returnees have ended up in prison with sentences ranging up to 5 years, as the UN is reluctant to carry out its responsibilities of repatriation. It was actually a misconstrued thought for those representing the Rohingya refugees to expect relief from the army, since this is the same army which Suu Kyi had used to crack down upon the Muslims of Rakhine, raise their towns, kill them, and drive them across the borders into Bangladesh. Later, in an international court, this shameless woman tried to justify her crimes against humanity by defending the Myanmar military, which since August 2017 has been engaged in the ethnic cleansing and genocide of Rohingya Muslims. The UN, for its part, has procrastinated the crisis by saying that talks are being held for repatriation of the refugees and investigations are underway to determine the degree of the destruction wrought by the Myanmar regime. What investigations and what negotiations when everything is crystal clear? The whole world knows who the criminals are and the magnitude of their crimes against humanity. The squalor in which the Rohingya refugees live without adequate facilities and are being barred from entry into other neighboring countries speaks volumes of the plight of victims. In view of these facts, the world body and human rights organizations should end their inactiveness and swing into action to find a solution to the unending crisis, which is a blot on human conscience, a blot on Muslim conscience as well, since hundreds of billions of dollars are being squandered by the oil-rich Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf to kill fellow Muslims in West Asia, while dallying with the Zionists, the enemy of the Ummah.
a diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all Islamic denominations have in common. Remarks of the leader of the revolution about the 22nd of Bahman. The 22nd of Bahman is the day of the salvation of the Iranian nation and the day of the flourishing and victory of the greatest revolution of our history from the beginning of Islam to the present day. The period of our history is after Islam, and also in the sense that it is the day of flourishing the talents of our nation and taking advantage of the hardships and sufferings that this nation has endured during its great revolution and during the years of struggle and movement. We, the people of Iran, consider this revolution as our great Eid. Before this revolution, we were societies far from human will, far from Islam, under the domination of foreigners, under the domination of the arrogant. The material condition of our country and the spiritual condition of this nation were both bad. Our revolution began in the name of God and with the help and assistance of God for the victory of Islam and the elimination of oppression, and was achieved by enduring hardships for 15 years and more. From the first day of the victory of this revolution, we all said, and all the nations believed, that this work will not end with the victory of the American people in our country. The work will not end on February 13th, but the work will start on this great and happy day. On the 22nd of Bahman, we set foot on the paths, that the end of this path is an Islamic and human society that is comfortable, full of blessings, and equal to the command of God and the divine laws. We will gradually get closer to it. The 22nd of Bahman is a real holiday for our nation. The 22nd of Bahman is for our nation as the Eid al-Fitr, in which the nation came out of a difficult period of fasting, a time when they had imposed deprivation of spiritual and material nourishment on our nation. The 22nd of Bahman is the ruling of Eid al-Adha. The 22nd of Bahman is the ruling of Eid al-Qadir. Because it was on that day that the blessings of the province, the completion of the blessings and the completion of the divine blessings, became practical for the Iranian nation and a foreign realization. The march on the 22nd of Bahman must be done with greatness. Be careful not to hold a march or rally, however small, before the 22nd of Bahman. Keep in mind to ban such marches. If a certain group wants to march in a certain place, it should be after the 22nd of Bahman. On the 22nd of Bahman, the whole country should suddenly explode and people should take to the streets.
Oh, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you.
Yusuf Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
What often passes for cultured Parisian cool has been exposed as deadly indifference to suffering humanity following the death of René Robert, a famous photographer of flamenco music. The 85-year-old fainted while on a walk in one of the most crowded areas of Paris. He couldn't get up and then tragically died of hypothermia after being ignored for 9 hours. The death has shocked France and has shamed the capital city in news worldwide. Robert died likely because people assumed he was just another street person in a fabulously rich city where homelessness is somehow a common sight. The person who finally checked on Robert was a homeless person who probably knew all too well the indifference of Paris to people sleeping rough, even in winter.
Nous répétons toujours la même chose, hein?
We keep repeating the same things. Everyone needs access to a life with dignity. We ask for structural reforms which will have real impact on the lives of people living in precarious existence. There has been a disengagement from France regarding the basic social minimums required in life.
Officially, around 6,000 people die on the streets of France each year. But NGOs say the real number is closer to 3,000 people. Refugees, mostly from countries hit by Western military intervention, die out of sight and without identification in tents, pushed into unseen and unlivable corners of the country.
We consider the question of housing to be a vital effort we need to make. We are asking for the basic recognition that everyone needs a roof over their heads. We're asking all the candidates in this spring's election to recognize that a state must take care of people.
Annual budget cuts during the age of austerity have pushed even more poor and mentally ill people into the streets, with evictions exploding so much the government refuses to publish the data anymore. Paris is the most population-dense city in the Western world, but government housing policy favors landlords and not renters. None of these government policy choices really explains the passing of René Robert, but many hope his needless death can change France's indifference towards the plight of those living on the streets. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Leading business owners, producers, and entrepreneurs were invited to a special place, Beit Rahbari. That's the official residence of Iran's leader. The meeting was aimed at allowing industrialists to share their concerns and highlight the major challenges they face in the production process. With leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, listening
and taking notes.
Your Highness, production is always associated with problems. If we want to produce, we need to brace for any possible problems. I dare say even the world's biggest entrepreneur, Mr. Bill Gates, could not manage a coffee shop under these difficult circumstances. But Iranian producers manage to run their businesses with all the foreign-imposed hardships.
Let's not sacrifice domestic production for imports. I proudly say that our biotech products have the capacity to be exported to other countries if the government lends its support.
At a time when the coronavirus pandemic led many countries to face shortage in medical supplies, Iran faced yet another problem, U.S. sanctions. But thanks to the efforts of our medical